This is the Education Gadfly Show.
As a former teacher, I can promise you there is no magic button that you can press to get people to stop talking.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Martha Raddatz of Education Reform, Alyssa Schwenk.
Thank you, Mike. Happy to be here.
And yes, the Anderson Cooper of Education Reform, David Griffith.
Thank you, Mike. Bye. What a weekend.
What?
Wow, you sounded super enthusiastic right there.
What a weekend, though. You know, a lot of people thought the moderators did a decent job at the debate. I guess Mr. Trump did not think so. Some of his supporters did not think so, but you know, it's hard to moderate these debates, and they work pretty well together as a team.
Yeah, I thought it was a town hall format, and I was surprised at how frequently they were like in there steering the conversation, which I thought was very much needed.
Yeah.
As a former teacher, I can promise you there is no magic button that you can press to get people to stop talking. So I have sympathy for the moderators. What do people think they're supposed to do?
Well, you need that Austin Powers button where, you know, people, the seat just falls out from under them.
I think it's a simple, like you just mute the microphone.
You mute, right. Know. The mute button. Exactly. I need one of those, Alyssa, for the podcast.
Don't look at me.
Right. Although, you know, I feel like what really happens is that Alyssa has the mute button. You know, she goes to Audrey afterwards and says, take out that part when Mike said X, Y, and Z.
That does not happen. It's like when I say don't do something, you didn't do the exact opposite.
That's,
okay, got it.
You have to know that's what coaches always say. You never put it in the negative. You always have to say it in the positive. You have to say to Mike, stay focused on education reform.
All right, Mike, let's stay focused on education reform.
Okay, we will, because it is time for Ed Reform Update. Love that jingle. Okay, but we are going to be back to talking about the election today, but specifically about how teachers should or should not talk about the election. There's a great article up on Politico, which really is, it just takes a bunch of interviews from teachers about how they are dealing with this election in their classroom. Always a difficult thing every 4 years because you don't want to politicize the classroom. Certainly as a parent, I don't want teachers, in any way, try and persuade my kids about what they should think about politics. Certainly as a teacher, you look out there, you don't know the political views of the kids or their parents. Mm-hmm. But this election, with all the name calling and some of the policy positions Mr. Trump has taken various groups feel attacked by. And then now the tape. You guys have both been teachers, David in high school, Alyssa in elementary school. Mm-hmm. How should teachers handle this?
Yeah, I mean, this one is a tricky one. And first, I mean, I don't think teachers are necessarily, like, this is not totally unfamiliar territory to them. Plenty of people who are still teaching were teachers on 9/11. When you're a teacher, you're frequently asking kids at all grade levels to confront not nice portions of our history and to contextualize it and to talk about it. You know, when I was teaching kindergarten, and we were discussing the civil rights movement. And that was something that with my minority students, like that was really close to home and like opened some conversations that I wasn't expecting to have, but I think were really good teachable moments. So I think kind of the first thing that I think of when I think about these things is like drawing on the lessons and the things that you're already trying to teach your students about kindness and about tolerance and about open-mindedness and like bringing those things that you've already taught or have experienced teaching like into your practice as well.
Now, David, one of the teachers in this article from the interview, I think he was a high school teacher. He just says, I don't talk about politics. I just say there's a no talk zone because the only thing that could happen is I get in trouble. Whatever happens with this discussion and just say, we're not talking about it. I mean, is that what you got to do? What if you're the civics teacher? I mean, how do you handle this?
Yeah, you know, I was the civics teacher, and I disagree with that pretty strongly. Look, I think there's a difference between young kids and high schoolers. I don't know. Do you think your average third grader, I mean, they're aware of the election?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right?
Have you talked to my son, Nico?
Yeah, and in high school, they're definitely aware, I think.
He's not the typical third grader. I happen to have a very gifted child. But anyways, you were saying.
Look, I'm going to go back to foundational documents here. All right. We have a basic social contract and it involves some very basic things. And if teachers can't speak up for civility and substance in our public dialogue, then we are lost as a country. And I refuse to endorse the view that they shouldn't be able to speak up for those things because some people might object. Now, I'm not saying there's not a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it or a smart way to do it and an unwise or foolish way to do it. But, you know, we have to be able to endorse some norms, or there's really no point in having civics class, right? I mean, we don't teach the Constitution at, you know, as sort of some sort of like option, right? And we don't teach, we don't teach some of our more difficult periods of our history as a, you know, you take it or you leave it. I understand that there are going to be varied opinions about this, but ultimately high school civics classes are supposed to be where kids start to learn how not to do what's going on in this election, right? How to engage with each other civilly.
Yeah.
And so if we don't model it then, when do we do it?
Yeah. So, and lots of issues. You could imagine some great high school civics class discussions, right? Let's talk about this proposed ban on Muslims that I guess has been rescinded, and talk about First Amendment rights. So we talk about immigration over the years and pros and cons of different, you know, how do we decide as a country which immigrants we want to let in, which we don't. I mean, you could imagine substantive conversations about that, right? Mm-hmm. But then you get to this just scandalous, awful language and the tape, right? Listen, back to you for the little kids, right?
Okay.
I mean, okay, so I have a third grader and a kindergartner. I have tried to make sure they don't hear that tape. I think I have succeeded. Mm-hmm. Should I assume that they're hearing about it though on the playground? I mean, what and how do you deal with
that? I mean, knowing about your kids' classes, I would assume that yes, they're probably hearing about
what does that mean?
Your kids
hang out with a bunch of ruffians?
No. Your kids go to school in suburban DC. Like, it's probably something that is being discussed at home.
But I hope they're not hearing the P word, right? I mean,
Yeah, I don't think you can talk. I mean, you obviously don't use the P word at school, right? But I think, you have to, I think one thing as a teacher, I don't know. I wouldn't assume that every teacher has heard, right? So I think it's one thing. If a kid brings it up, you have to deal with it, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't have to deal with it with the class as a whole, right?
And the point has got to be that, look, I mean, on the one hand, there's this argument for political balance. We don't want to be biased. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you certainly, as a teacher, say it's not right to touch somebody who doesn't want to be touched, you know?
I mean, I think there are...
I mean, that's just like a basic... That's not political.
Right. I think there are, you know, just some basic norms that you have probably already addressed. It's the beginning of the school year. You've probably built your rules as a class or whatever kind of method you're, like, setting these ground rules in terms of, like, what to discuss and when with kids. Like, I'm dating myself, but I was in elementary school when the Clinton scandals broke back in the 90s. And it was something that you do kind of have to negotiate, I think, with parents. And if it comes up in school, like I would, and I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who taught elementary school, like make sure that that's communicated, that it was brought up or someone brought that up to make sure the lines of communication are clear. But certainly I wouldn't be necessarily getting into specifics with very young children.
Mm-hmm. Now that piece is great. The communication with parents that if it comes up, it's so easy now. I mean, you know, the teachers take 5 minutes and email the whole class of parents and say, hey, this came up. Here's how it went down. I wanted you to know about this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think at the high school level, just, you know, the more you can do to contextualize it and try to help the kids understand that it hasn't always been this way, right? And it doesn't have to be this way. And this isn't what they should expect out of their politicians. You know, if I were teaching right now, I would be very tempted to go back and show, you know, like a Reagan debate, right? And then maybe find an acceptable portion of modern debates and talk about the difference, right? And talk about maybe like talk to the kids about what's happened and why. And, you know, whenever you're treading on territory, sort of controversial territory, I always try to distinguish between my view, what the Constitution says, what Democrats think, what Republicans or conservatives, liberals, how you have it, right? Like, I don't think the teacher necessarily has to remove themselves from the conversation in terms of their opinion, but just sort of labeling it when they're bringing it up or when they feel the need to put it out there.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a teacher by teacher decision and a class by class decision, and it depends on a whole host of issues. Like, I'm not saying definitely do this, definitely do that. I think it's more of a just like taking advantage of the teachable moments and knowing that, you know, as a teacher, you're helping to build the next generation of citizens. And there is an opportunity fraught as it sort of is right now.
Okay, we will let Alyssa have the last word. Thank you, guys. A lot, very helpful. Again, do check out the political article. A lot of wisdom from teachers in that. And as Alyssa reminded me, less than 30 days until this whole awful thing is over. Thank goodness. Okay, that's all the time we've got for Ed Reform Update. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
We were just talking about how teachers should deal with this presidential election in their class. What do you think? You taught English, high school English. If kids wanted to talk about the debate, would you go there? If you want to talk about this, the tape?
How hard is that? I just would want to not go there, right? Because teachers are supposed to like talk about both sides, right? And the importance of debate and importance of backing evidence with your opinions. Mm-hmm. I guess I could go that route, right? Yep. Mm-hmm. But you'd really have to watch a careful line, right? Yeah. Because you could get very quickly into talking about your own opinion, which you would not want to do in this situation.
Were there themes in, when you look back to the books that you taught back then, were there any that dealt with themes about, you know, how men treat women or
Of Mice and Men? No. Grapes of Wrath?
Scarlet Letter.
Nope. Scarlet Letter? Okay, yeah. A little Scarlet Letter.
I put that one in the list.
Yeah, I mean, but you kind of had to dig for that. Anyway, what do you have for us this week, Amber? All right.
What do you have over at Amber? Research Minute.
Yes. I plugged a new Fordham report. Yay, me.
Oh, good.
Charter school boards in the nation's capital ask a simple question, but one that has mostly been ignored. Which is, do the characteristics, views, and practices of charter school boards have any bearing on charter school quality, right? That's a good, great question. We know very little about traditional school boards. We know even less about charter boards. So we partnered with Bellwether Education Partners. We surveyed all charter boards in D.C., which is actually a pretty good scale, right? Because there's almost half the kids in D.C., as we know, are in charter schools, the public school kids. And we've got about 62 boards that oversee 112 campuses. Plus, D.C.'s kind of neat because they operate under a single set of regulations, a uniform set of school quality metrics. And as we know, the single authorizer, which is D.C. Public Charter School Board, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. known to be both transparent and rather rigorous. Mm-hmm. Okay. So on the flip side, just real quickly, it's also atypical, right? Because again, you've got it's a pretty big sector, relatively speaking, and you don't have any suburban or rural charters like you might in other mm-hmm. places. So it's not exactly generalizable what I'm going to share.
And there's been efforts in D.C. to try to identify great people for charter school boards, certainly hasn't happened mm-hmm. in every other city, but probably should happen.
Probably should happen.
Great people like you, Amber.
Why, thank you.
Because Amber is a charter school board member. Did you take this survey?
I did. Is that
okay?
I put a note somewhere. Okay? I was like, maybe we should have put a note there and a footnote.
Not a miss. Yeah. But anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
I just got to say, we killed ourselves with a survey over a 50% response rate.
That was huge.
Never happened.
Unheard of.
It was 51%. But come on, that never happens. I mean, never happens. Way to go, Amber. So anyway, we got an accurate picture of charter boards in D.C. You cannot say that we didn't because mm-hmm. we got a great response rate. Anyway, kudos to Bellwether, because obviously Julie and they was awesome. Whatever. I'm on a rabbit trail. Anyway, five key differences for the study. Okay. Number one, charter boards in DC tend to be affluent, diverse, highly educated, and liberal. All right. Mm-hmm. More specifically, a slight majority is white. One third are African American. They are fairly evenly distributed by age. All right. And they have a wide range of occupational backgrounds. Although almost a third are in education.
Hmm.
62%, kind of high, don't have school-age children. 96% graduated from a four-year college or university. Mm-hmm. And a whopping, take a guess, how many have advanced degrees? What percentage?
I know the answer, so I will pass.
Oh, you guys both remember the stat. 79% for our listeners. 51% report a household income greater than $200,000. And just 2% report less than 50,000.
These are the Washington elite.
They are. And the D.C. median household, by the way, in 2014 was 91,000. Just to put these numbers in mm-hmm. perspective, Number two, boy, that was a lot of number one. Board members of high quality schools are more knowledgeable about their schools. They're more likely to know their school's ranking. They're more likely to know more about their school's poverty population, about their school's finances. They just are more knowledgeable. Mm-hmm. Okay. Number three, these board members of high quality schools are more likely to participate in training, engage in things like strategic planning, and meet monthly. Mm-hmm. So they take place in take part in things like how to develop a school budget. Again, how to make a strategic plan and various legal and policy issues. Number four, they're significantly more likely to evaluate their school leader and to use staff satisfaction as a factor in those evaluations. So they mm-hmm. get input about their leader, they rate that leader consistently, and they use staff satisfaction. So whatever you want to make of that. And then last, regardless of school quality, they also have a bunch of things in common. So these are the things that weren't statistically significant differences.
That all charter boards in DC. Right.
Whether you're low, medium, or high quality. They share the belief that academic achievement is the primary goal of a quality education, which we didn't incidentally see in another study we did about traditional boards. We can talk about that later. Mm-hmm. And they also have a similar practices in how they steward public funds. So they all kind of approach that similarly. And they understand that their role is to govern the school, not micromanage it.
Amen. Right? Mm-hmm.
And then this is just kind of an aside, but we can talk about this too. There was similar misunderstanding about the role of the DC Charter School Board. Okay, so one in four thought that they were responsible for assisting the school leader in the school's operations, which would be overstepping their role. And one in three thought it was not their responsibility to close underperforming schools, which clearly that is one of their obligations. Huh. So a lot of interesting stuff. And of course, we wrote a forward and talked about some other stuff. But hey, it's well worth your time to read this report. And I'm biased, but I'm speaking the truth.
You know, this it's a great study. It, as we're very clear, it is just DC. So you have to be careful about taking the results elsewhere. But
and it's not causal.
And it's not causal. But look, here's the thing is what I really want people to understand around the country is that if you are engaged in trying to build a high quality charter school sector, which many of our colleagues are, that paying attention to who's on these charter boards is important. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that's gotten much attention. You know, in that in DC, there have been a couple of groups, charter board partners, mm-hmm. right?
Board on Track is another
Board
one.
On Track.
And, you know, they have made a lot of effort to identify people who are, you know, very talented in their professional capacities and are eager to give back and to volunteer their time.
And to match their skills, right?
And
to
match
say,
their skills,
this school needs somebody who knows finance. Hey, here's a finance person. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then these people also become great advocates for charter schools and, you know, so this is social capital. We say this in the foreword, right? That Jim Coleman would smile at the social capital on these boards. Something to pay attention to in your city as well.
Yes.
One last thing. Is this the first study that has ever found professional development to matter? I mean, you know.
Definitely the first one from Fordham.
Let's just say this. Charter Board Partners does a lot of the PD around town. So it also matters, like, who's delivering this.
I mean, it's so rare that we find that it matters for teachers. But it seems to matter for board members.
Yes.
So there you go.
That's
intriguing.
It's intriguing.
Yes.
Not sure what else to do.
Well, thank you. That. A great study. Hey, every once in a while, we got to toot our own horn. There's nothing wrong with that. But that is all the time we've got to toot our horn this week. Until next week.
I'm Alyssa Schwenk.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.